Well, Dr. Darsa, it is awesome to have you on.
Thank you, Jerry,
for joining me.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
Of course. So for listeners, I found you, I think, on Facebook because your group, you were very savvy in having a Facebook group that, like, for early readers, for people to write reviews and things for your book, and it really interested me. So that's how we met.
Yes, my book launch group is what I called it.
Nice.
Yes.
So this is going to be a really good episode because Dr. Carol Darsa just published the book, The Trauma Map, 5 Steps to Reconnect with Yourself, which is such a great title too.
Thank you.
Yeah, that idea of reconnecting with yourself really permeates the book. And I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence, right? Because your practice is called the Reconnect Integrative Trauma Treatment Center.
That is how I came up with the title, with the name Reconnect, because I do see the disconnect that happens following a trauma.
Yeah.
So, and then I decided to put that name in the book as well.
Which is awesome. How long have you been a psychologist?
22 years now.
So you have drawn from quite a bit of clinical experience here.
Yes. Yes, many. Yeah.
What really inspired you, or what few things, if it's more than one, inspired you to write this book?
Few things for sure. One is I find myself doing a lot of psychoeducation in sessions because I think it's so important for people to understand what trauma really is. And I noticed that they don't actually know. Clients who come in, they say things like, well, I am not a sexual abuse survivor. I probably don't have trauma. I'm not sure if you can help me because sexual abuse is one of my specialties. And I say, let's get a little bit of history about your childhood. Well, my mom died when I was young. Okay, that's trauma. Oh, just people really don't know what it is. And so I started educating people a lot. And then I wished I could actually give them sort of handouts to say, okay, here's what it is, so that I'm not repeating myself. And then I started thinking, I wish I could do a workbook to give to the clients while they're in treatment, because I have some sort of a sequential way of working with people. I like to do this first and then that, and then this. I'm very organized that way.
Yeah.
So I was writing a workbook, and from workbook, it turned into a book. Maybe the workbook will follow now.
Well, I think that you have an amazing template for that. So for anyone out there, I really urge you to check out the book on Amazon. I'll put a link in the podcast and the YouTube video, but I mean, a workbook is usually something that has a lot of quantified, discrete, separate steps, and your book is written like that. And when you and I were talking, planning this interview, one of the things you told me was a lot of the books out there are great, but they're written from a practitioner perspective to other practitioners. And you really wanted to do something that was for clients and used way more accessible language.
That's right. In fact, thank you for reminding me, because that was my second motivation of writing the book, because people were coming and asking me if I can refer a book for them. And all the books out there, in my opinion, are great, but they're very heavy language. And I don't know if you noticed, but a lot of people with especially PTSD have a hard time to concentrate. And
yes.
I can't read. I can't sit down and read. And I said, okay, so how can I do something much simpler? And so my goal was really to keep it as simply written and as easy to read as possible. So some people say they finished the book in 2 days.
It's great that you were able to make something that doesn't sacrifice the clinical truths, but also doesn't unnecessarily complicate them. Because I think that's a really tough tightrope for a lot of clinicians to walk. I notice when I'm talking to clients, like I want to explain dissociation to them, but then maybe explaining it in the medical depth that I would think, you know, that I would want to as kind of a neuroscience nerd, that's probably not necessary. You want them to understand the mechanics of it enough, how it relates to them, which I think you do really well in the book.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's wonderful you brought that up too, because I find myself, and we'll get to this too, but doing EMDR, I explain, it's you can almost, I'm sure with you, you have way more experience than I do, but when you start talking to certain clients and you can tell that the depression or anxiety that they're in quotes, coming in with is very likely trauma, right? And you know you're going to have a whole song and dance where you explain to them that trauma is more than sexual abuse or wartime stuff, like you just said. Right. I mean, so to have something like that ready to explain, I mean, and I love that you went into detail for anybody out there, the ACEs study, which is like just ubiquitous. It's very big in any trauma circle. Anyone who knows about trauma as a therapist is going to talk about the adverse childhood experiences scale, ACEs. Right. And so you talk about that and explain that there's a lot in there that's not just sexual abuse, right? Like the parent attempting suicide, things like that, that just really leave an imprint on someone.
Right. And plain emotional neglect. I think that's the one that's the most minimized, because people yes. say, oh, my parents were there. I think they loved me. They took care of me. I had food and, you know, and everything. But then there's no depth. There's no attunement. There's no like parents sitting with a child going, how are you? How are you feeling? I really care about you. What you say is important. How you feel is important. If there's not that, that's also traumatic for a child. And I find that relational trauma is the least known. So everything else, the war, the racism, earthquakes, okay, these are traumas. But people don't understand the importance of relational trauma, because we're supposed to have good bonding with our parents. And when we don't, whenever something is out of nature, is when we could be really traumatized.
That's such a great point. And I wonder if culturally the reason for that, maybe it's easier for people to point to events that happen to them as trauma rather than the lack of something, rather than a lack of love. If they don't know what love was like, they're not going to know to say, I wasn't. They're going to think, well, I got gifts sometimes, or my parents tried to buy my love, but they weren't around. And they may not have a framework for what healthy looks like because they didn't know it.
Right.
It's, and I think sadly, there's really a need for this kind of discussion now, because out and about, I mean, well, now obviously in COVID-19 times, which you address in the book, we'll get to that. But depending on if people are out or at home or whatever, you might not see this. But I remember seeing, and even recently, people out at malls and out with their kids, and it's like they're there but not there. And I want to be very careful not to criticize parents, because I know people are going through a lot, again, especially now. Yeah. But if you're not making eye contact, connecting, and I like that you brought attachment in, because attachment trauma is severely neglected as a neglect, and attachment trauma are just, we need to really up the ante on our efforts for that as clinicians, I think, because people don't know what they don't know about this. And when you see the kids trying to talk to parents and parents are on the phone, or just, you know, all of these daily disconnects that even a dozen times a day, whatever, but if that's all kids are getting from their parents, and if there's no connection, that cumulatively adds up, right?
Right. And we are talking about that accumulation. That's an important thing to say, because I'm a parent myself, and I know how easy it is to get into this feeling of guilt. Oh, I didn't spend enough time. And then there's an opposite movement happening, where you're just, as a parent, put everything on hold, including yourself, and just give to a child.
Right.
Also not good. So there's sort of this extreme things happening. I think in the old generation, we were all neglected. And so when we all turn parents, we tend to give a lot. So we're not talking about, yes, if you are on the phone, you don't have to be glued to your child. We're talking about chronic not bonding, chronic not being in attunement with your child, and
absolutely.
Then not going to you for anything, because they don't think that you'll be there for them.
Right, 100%, yeah. Just that, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, because this is not so understood, that's why I really wanted to make sure that in the book people understand that, because people who don't understand what trauma is tend to blame themselves a lot for everything. Oh, I'm a weak person, I'm not strong, and that's why I don't feel good, depression or anxiety is something about who they are, like their identity in a way. And there's a lot of blame and self-hatred. And as long as you blame yourself, you can't feel good about anything anyway. So when they understand that it actually comes from trauma, not because they are weak, it starts really providing a different sense of healing. And then we can work on it. We can improve it.
Yeah, I like that you particularly on that point discuss the importance of recognizing fight, flight, and freeze And to break that down, I've probably talked about this a dozen times on my podcast, but for anyone just listening to this one, the idea of, like, as a child, dissociation coming from freezing because you knew you couldn't fight or flee, right, as a kid, I think that's where people get this weakness. You had a story in there of someone who, of a woman who couldn't understand why after her martial arts training, she didn't fight back when it came, like, the do or die time, right? And so you broke that down, explained that freezing is a response that people exhibit in those situations. And so you helped pull away that perception of weakness by, again, using psychoeducation, as you said.
Right, right. The psychoeducation is a very important part and is the beginning, which is why I start with the connecting to mind piece. Like, if you don't have the psychoeducation piece, all the emotional stuff, everything else kind of falls behind. So I'd like to always start there. It's also just the least triggering thing, because I'm not asking them to feel something, because sometimes feeling is tough, right? If you're a trauma survivor, you didn't want to deal with the feelings, so you learn how to put them aside. So I don't like to start with just making them feel things. I want to just first to explain. And so that's sort of how the book starts. And then gradually I go deeper into, okay, now let's talk about feelings. Now let's talk about the body. Those are the three very important things. After you understand in your head, then we can talk about feeling the body, feeling the feelings. But even that, the most important thing about the book for me is how it has to be gradual. It has to have a slow and respecting way of working on trauma. Because we are under the impression that everything has to be hard. Let's do it. Go for it. Kind of like sports. But trauma is not like that. This isn't about doing. This is about being gentle. This is about being slow. And that's one of the, I think, maybe the biggest myth about mental health in the world. You know, the secret, right? Like, you can do anything if you just put your mind to it. Huh, it doesn't work like that for trauma. So that was important for me to explain in the book.
I love that. Yeah, I have to say, I have a real skepticism for a lot of the quick self-help stuff because it looks nice and it, in theory, sounds good. But I'm right there with you. There's less application to people who have been through severe trauma. And that's why we need books like this that counter that. Like, the best parts that people like about those books and those quick methods and the kind of positive manifestation stuff is it makes sense, it's easy to understand, and they can kind of memorize it easily. And I think the only way to defeat those very, like, we could call, like, the processed food version of truth, like a processed sort of very hokey marketed version of healing, is with the kind of stuff like that you and other therapists are putting out now that says, okay, here are five big overarching steps to get better. You want something that's easy to keep in mind? Here it is.
Right.
Yeah. So I speaking of that, just to nail what the five steps are, because you hit on it, it's understanding trauma. That's the first one, which I love, because you go into the historical basis of it and how it was understood over time, starting with Genet, the famous French psychologist that really got the ball rolling on that. Reconnect to your mind, reconnect to your body. Okay. Of course, mind first with psychoeducation. Reconnect to your heart and emotions. And then once you've done all that self-care, reconnect to spirituality, community, and nature. So it's very cool that those are very intentional steps that you set out, very ordered.
Yes.
You want to get yourself built back up where you can handle any kind of interpersonal stuff before really leaping back in.
Well, because if there's no internal relationship, there's nothing really outside that will work. And that's where a lot of the people, what they're missing. And that's where, again, hence the name Reconnect, really connecting to yourself, right? As I was saying earlier, trauma creates a disconnect inside. There's some sort of an internal split in some way that happens. And that's the pain that we feel as trauma survivors after the fact. It's not only what happened, but it's the effect of what happened and how then we treat ourselves. So if you remember some of my sentences is, if you're abandoned, you may abandon yourself.
Yes.
If you're abused, you may abuse yourself. If you're told you are bad, you're going to think of yourself as bad. These parents or early attachment figures become really the role models of how you think you should be treated. And that becomes a pattern. So if we can work on that, in fact, that's the reason why sometimes you don't even need the memory of the trauma necessarily to heal, but really understand the impact of that in yourself. Because if you're talking to yourself in a way you were talked to, and by just changing that, you could actually heal some of the past, at least build the strength. And I call this sort of, I don't know if I wrote this word in there, but emotional support, immune system. You know,
yeah.
How physical immune system. This is like an emotional immune system. If your immune system is strong, then illness doesn't affect you. So you can strengthen it by, and some of the exercises I gave in the book.
Yes.
For that.
You and gave a lot of good ones, and we'll talk about that in a minute. I don't want to get too ahead of myself because I wanted to ask, this is a good segue. Your own experiences that led you to write this book, your own immigration here at age 20 from Turkey, I think it was age 20. Talk to us a little bit about that if you want, just anything you think is relevant.
Sure. I came to study psychology. Little I knew that actually Southern California is really the heaven for it. So I was very lucky. I've done just all my schooling here, undergrad, grad school, and then I decided to be a psychologist, work with foster kids first and a lot of other abused children subsequently. Just trauma has always been my interest. And then I just opened my trauma treatment center about 8 years ago, actually. 6 years ago, 8 years ago, first another one, and then closed that one and opened another one in 6 years ago. But trauma, I thought, was just really underneath of everything. I was working in addiction treatment centers, and I could see, okay, the addiction comes from trauma. That's why someone's using something, because they want to forget something else. And that's the way that they could forget. So yeah, trauma has always been my passion.
I love that you bring that up because I have the same view. I worked in an agency setting before for a long time, getting my license and, you know, grinding it out, getting hours, helping a lot of hurting people. And of course, addictions treatment is really big. And there's some good models for that. But I think they all fall short if they don't take into account it's not just about tolerance or withdrawal or the medical model. That is certainly important as a psychoeducational facet. But what are you running away from? What is this substance doing for you? Those questions have to be asked.
Right.
I've hardly ever met a client who it was just because of fluke they smoked something with friends or got into heavy drug use because purely their friends were doing it. There was usually some prompting event that was like, I'm gonna do this as a way to triangulate my symptoms, to get away from them. And if we miss that, then there's really no, we're not replacing, we have to replace a habit, an addiction with something else. We cannot just take it away. That's taking away defense mechanism without building up the person's internal strength.
Right, exactly. And that's where you have to look into what the trauma is about and to know, okay, there's a trauma here and not to minimize the impact of it. It's not about blaming the parents. It's not always the parents, by the way.
Oh, no, I agree. No, and not at all. And because, I mean, I've had clients who come from, and see, that's why we widen the scope to look at trauma from a different lens. It's not always parental abuse. It could be from someone outside the family and parents might not even know how their kids are trying to cope. And so the only thing there that could possibly be directed toward the parents is having better ways of communicating with their kid. But again, you can, it's a slippery slope to say what you could have done because ultimately people make decisions. And if they don't let anybody into those or talk about it first, it's tough for anybody to gauge.
Right.
So I get that.
It's not, of course, always abuse, as we said earlier. So I think another one that's maybe neglected in terms of what trauma is medical issues. Growing up with an illness, either your own illness or an illness of a parent, is very traumatic. It's like facing death on an ongoing basis. I had many clients who had terminally ill parents for years, 10, 15 years, waiting for the parents almost to die. Not that they wanted them.
Yeah, right.
Anticipating when I'm going to get the news that my father, my mom is going to die. And that is hugely traumatic for a child growing up because I always say anything against nature could be really stressful and could be traumatic because children are only supposed to play, enjoy their lives, clean their rooms, go to school, and have community. Anything more than that is too much for a child to handle.
Oh man, now we're getting into the this is an unwieldy term, but the parentification of kids, like the adult children of alcoholics syndrome, which is kind of, that's an older conceptual model, but I think it's useful to look at, like if someone learned that the opposite, so like I'll see this too in people who have the tendency to want to fix a partner or go after partners continually who need help, right? To the detriment of the client's own mental well-being. It's like, what did you learn growing up? Oh, well, I had to help my mom. I had to help my dad. And so naturally they take on this role as a helper to anyone they're intimate with. And it kind of, that's a traumatic replication. That's that repetition compulsion that Freud talked about. And that's so big in trauma, of trying to redeem past situations. That's what at least comes to mind for me.
Yes. And that's another good example of what trauma is and how people don't know that it was traumatic, especially if they grew up that way. To them, that was the norm.
Yeah. I mean, and there's the neglect epidemic is so unbelievably relevant here. I'm glad that you talk so much about relational trauma and the impact that has, because there's almost, and I'm sure you've noticed this, with clients who've gone through relational trauma, they are often the ones who, as we said earlier, will say, well, my trauma doesn't count. It's like part of their trauma is thinking that it's not, and that they don't deserve to label it as such.
Right. Or they don't deserve the attention that they could get.
Right. Right. So that's crucial too, is the clients aren't going to say, hi, I have trauma. Here's how to get rid of it. It's like, it's our job to figure it out. And this book helps people look at it and say, oh, I identify with this story or with that one. Like, wow, I'm not crazy. People will say, it'll be like, am I crazy for this? It's like, first of all, no, we don't use that kind of language. But second of all, you had a perfectly understandable reaction and way of dealing as a kid with stuff that you couldn't possibly have stood up to.
Right. You just said the right word. Am I crazy? I get that question all the time.
I do too. It's funny. That's the term people use yes. for it. And it's weird because people who are otherwise so functional are very frightened when they enter this regress state, which you talk about a client who goes back to her. I this is all fresh in my mind because I was recently reading your advanced copy. But like the client who is in her 40s, I think, who regresses to being 13 and crossing her legs, and you like gently call that out and are talking about it. And it's like that person feel like just going into that alternate ego state can feel very crazy to people who are very high functional, but then those blind spots, those things that elicit somatic physical memories, send them into a place that is very out of tune with the present, that can make them feel like they're losing their minds. And so I hear that a lot of people will be like, well, I feel like I'm that age again, am I crazy? It's like, no, that's a somatic, very strong marker that comes up and takes you there.
Right. That's when the trauma hijacks you, is one way you can say it. When they say, am I crazy? I like to replace that word with injured. I say,
yeah,
because you're injured. They never think there's an emotional injury. People think injuries and illness are only on the physical realm, on the physical body. But, and that's how we can actually, I'm jumping maybe a little bit, but
please.
I want to make the mental health issues more normal. Right? Because when a person has cancer and they are in treatment, this is not a secret. It's even put on Facebook. Hey, I have cancer. I need support. But the moment it's a mental illness, no one knows. It's a secret. A few people, I'm telling you, I'm going to treatment. And, you know, the embarrassment and the weakness. Like, I am weak for having this depression. I am weak for, but you're injured. You have an emotional injury or you have an emotional illness. And it needs to be treated. I mean, mental health awareness, right?
It's very absolutely important. I think, yeah, it's difficult because people sometimes know they're going to get a negative response for bringing that up. So it's tough for people to be the first ones to overcome the stigma.
Right.
And yeah, no, I really get what you're throwing down on that level. So remind me, I think we spoke about this. You're trained as an EMDR clinician, right?
I am trained as EMDR, brain spotting, somatic experiencing, and sensory motor.
Wow. Okay. Just a small resume there. Wow. That is awesome. So you really integrate a lot of it. If I had to pick one that I don't know. I'm an EMDR consultant, so that's been my kind of big thing. But
If you would pick one, I would say choose one of the somatic ones.
No, no, of course, right. Well, yeah, so not brain spotting, more the SE, the sensory motor experiencing by Daniel Levine, right? Peter Levine.
There's Peter Levine's somatic experiencing
and Pat Ogden
for sensory motor. I've studied both for a couple of years and I like different things from each of them. I've actually recently, I don't know if you're okay with me talking about this because it's not completely with the book, but I just created a new model that I'm calling Reconnect Integrative Trauma Treatment Model.
Yeah, talk about that. Of course I'm okay with that. That's great.
And the acronym is RITM, not rhythm with a TH, but RITTM, RITM. It's a model of these different modalities all combined. So I'm training professionals, clinicians actually, with that. So I just started my classes in Turkey. I finished my second module and I'm starting the classes in the US via Zoom. If you're interested, I'll send you the flyer. So it's going to be over like a bunch of weekends and then along with a certificate at the end so people can become trauma certified. And it's much more body oriented. So it is using some eye movement, eye spots, body stuff, and also a little bit of Gestalt because I was trained in Gestalt earlier. So sort of a combination of all of that.
That's pretty awesome. Peter Levine's idea of trauma as interrupted movement, like you were trapped and couldn't move, that is such an easy, like that is a very powerful description, I find, for clients to understand, like what happened is there was this trapped impulse to escape. And then when they feel like they're in similar situations, they again feel powerless.
Right, the incomplete actions in the body.
Yes, yeah.
And how you complete them is that's part of the sensory motor. They talk about the same thing as
well. Yeah, no, I love that. And that's not to get too much off topic again on my end, but I wrote a paper that was published in the International EMDR Journal this month. And it was like, I didn't write it this month, that's for sure. It took a while to re-edit everything. But this idea of trauma as incompletion and that eye move, like EMDR builds that drive to completion because eye movements keep interrupting and the check-ins interrupt. And there's that paradoxical effect of like people then think, oh, I want to complete this. And there's that like state-dependent memory component of trauma was kind of a form of interruption. And so eye movements kind of play into that.
Right.
And there's that like titrated like processing. Even Shapiro said like an interrupted processing is important to EMDR. And that's something that sets it apart from just a prolonged exposure where you're just white knuckling through it.
Right.
It's like trauma as an interruption that you go back and heal. Like with EMDR, the eye movements help to bring up the memories more completely, like the horizontal eye movements, like you're putting that together too. So anyway, Levine has always, he wrote a lot about that. So I drew on him a lot in my writing. I just haven't been trained in his stuff. So I've always thought, oh, that's cool. But what you're doing is integrating the best of it, it sounds like.
The best of what I think it's been working for 20 years in my experience. And what the good feedback I've been getting so far is that sometimes one technique doesn't work with a certain client, then what do we do? If you're only doing somatic, there are people who can't go to their bodies. And if you do eye movement, there are people who don't like it or who don't benefit or who react negatively. But when you have a few different tools, then you can just sort of pick and choose, which is what I've been doing. And I'm like, well, why don't I just put them together and teach? Because I've been supervising my staff a lot. And so I decided to make this more nationally now. So hopefully I'll be able to continue with that because
I think it's going to be great. People need that now more than ever. I mean, so you're also going to see people. Well, I got so many different directions to bounce off of, but I'll continue with this one. The reason I asked about EMDR and this kind of turned into a side conversation is because, which is great. That's where a lot of good conversation happens is off on tangents. But your book is written with a lot of attention to preparation. That's really what it is. Like you lay out, this book is about step one, stabilization of Janae's model. It's about keeping yourself in that optimal window of tolerance, which is another one of those, you know, ubiquitous trauma therapy concepts of just aroused enough. Like it, of course with stabilization, right, very low arousal, but the ability to think about or talk about it to an extent, like stabilize yourself before reprocessing.
Right.
And so
that is one of the most common mistakes that happen out there. People really not knowing this about stabilization phase. So I've actually been seeing both. It's either completely ignored and just jumping into the memory, or the opposite. They try to do stabilization so long that it's not really stabilization, but it's more just sort of maybe just DBT. So just like tools from a cognitive perspective, but not really an emotional stabilization. And then they go, oh, I can't do trauma processing with this client because look, he's still dissociating. Hello, teach him grounding. Teach him stuff about calming down the nervous system through their body. So you can prepare them, you know? That is definitely, I decided to write the book just from that perspective.
Yeah, therapists are people too. And so I think you have this dynamic interplay between therapist predisposition and personality and client need. And obviously it needs to be very heavily on the client need side, but unfortunately there tends to be a lot, I think, of like a lot of sort of bleed through of the clinician predilection. So it's like I had a colleague who was really, really good at working with offenders, sex offenders. And I mean, you wouldn't expect, she defied a lot of stereotypes. She was working in these very gritty environments, but didn't come across as that way at all in her personality. But she and I were trained in EMDR at the same time. And she had a fear of going too soon, too fast, and never really used EMDR a lot, I think, and kind of even left that modality behind out of fear of how powerful it is. And then you have, so like kind of more of a very organized, very almost perfectionistic stance, or a very kind of respectful stance toward EMDR. And then you get like the therapist who may be very, you could say, passionate and come from an altruistic place, right. But the implementation and their desire to see this person healed, they project so hard and they think that the person's ready when they're not, right? And go the other way, like you just said, of jumping in. Like you tell a whole story about a client who was led into reprocessing very soon and the therapist kept going. And then this is such a pet peeve of mine, didn't leave enough time to do the closure, the containment, we could say. It's like, well, look, I'm sorry. You can't send someone out your door because you ran over, like you end right up on that 51 mark and someone's dissociating. Like that is irresponsible. I don't care how long your session has been. If you opened it up, it's your obligation to close it.
Right, right. Unfortunately, I see that the most in treatment centers where they're not even doing EMDR, but they do processing in a different way in a group setting. And okay. I talked a little bit about that too, which I'd like to bring it up because that's a very common.
Please bring it up, yeah.
I want to say common mistakes that I have experienced because I have a treatment center. I have clients that come from different treatment centers, you know, step down like residential places into my outpatient program coming in and they tell me how they've been doing. And the stories that I hear is basically they feel like they've done a bunch of group therapy where they had to share a lot of details, which means you're opening up. And then you have like 10 different people all listening to each other's stories, all getting re-triggered by other people's traumas. And then that's it. And then they're done with the group and they're done with treatment. And so they come to us and they say, I actually feel like they opened me up and they never closed me down. This is exactly the word that they say. They know this opening and closing feeling in their body. So they're actually more dysregulated and or more dissociated. I had a client once, I don't think I wrote this in the book, but when I do professional trainings, I talk about her. She had an intake appointment for 2 hours at a treatment center. 2 hours of with every single detail of her trauma was asked about how the abuse occurred. And this is a woman who has attempted suicide many times in her life. And so she's highly fragile, substance abuse, eating disorder, and sexual abuse history. I mean, she has unfortunately everything. And of course, in the treatment centers, the counselor who do the intakes are not even licensed therapists. They're counselors. So they ask all these detailed questions and she leaves the treatment center, 24 hours later ends up in the hospital for a suicide attempt. So I talked to her about a month after that and I said, what took you there? And she said, they asked me such questions that I remembered things that I never remembered before and I didn't know what to do with this information. That can kill a person, like literally.
You know, That is unbelievably sad to hear, and I wish I could say that that was surprising, but I think, and it's very easy to go this direction, and we can go it, but the kind of managed care system where you've got a lot of cooks in the kitchen, and you've got to do certain things, and you got to do, like, I'm in Colorado right now, I'm moving back south next month, but there's a lot of state-based sort of inventories and things you give people and ask them questions and different things that get funding and different things. So everyone's run through this intake in a clinical setting, in a more kind of government-funded setting where this stuff is asked for a reason, and it's not always that individual client's benefit, right? It's more like to see what area needs funding. And that's fine. We have to do research and we have to be aware of what's going on. But the intake, when people just do intake assessments as their job, I think it becomes so regimented and they're so used to it that clients can sometimes be hammered with a lot of questions. And the clients, this is new for them. They're not ready for that.
Right. They're not ready. And if you can watch the person as they talk about how they're doing, you can prevent it.
Which absolutely.
Is what I'm talking about in the books, like make sure that the client has a capacity. Make sure you actually as a reader, because this isn't for therapists, but you as a reader have a capacity. For every exercise, I say, as you're doing it, stop and pause. Does that feel right for you? If it doesn't, do not push yourself. This idea of pushing oneself, it does not belong in the trauma. That's for other things that could be very helpful and effective, but not for trauma. So if a person is going to have to talk about something that they're not ready to talk about, only it's going to hurt them further.
Yeah.
I wrote something, not this example, but I wrote this notion because I wanted clients who read this book to really be careful as they go to therapies. And so they are, at least, even if the therapist doesn't know, my goal is that the clients will say, oh, wait a minute, she's making me talk about something I'm not ready and I'm feeling worse as I'm talking about, like my anxiety is increasing, or maybe I'm going to have a panic attack. Maybe I should stop. Like at least maybe my hope is to give them awareness of that self, the check-in. Check-in with yourself. How does it feel for you?
Absolutely. And that comes across from the first chapter. And your emphasis, the emphasis on knowing what trauma is and giving yourself some credit for having survived it versus the constant self-degradation and criticism that is part of trauma. But the emphasis on containment, which simply means, you know, preparation for reprocessing, not just EMDR. That's just my school of thought. But for anything. The checking with your body, doing the body scan, you include that in the book. You include a sort of pendulation exercise where you have people think about, like, notice what they're feeling in their body and go to their senses for 5 minutes while interacting in their world, then stop, then do it again. I thought that was a really good way to integrate that, like to build up that muscle of mindfulness, like any other habit.
Right. Right. And it is a muscle, you know, in a way, right? The checking in is like a muscle, becoming aware, and also gradually increasing your capacity for things. I mean, listen, if you've never run, can you do a 26-mile marathon tomorrow? There's no way you can. They give you, I don't know if you've ever got a schedule of how to prepare for a marathon, because at some point I was going to do it. And so the first week is 3 miles a day. And then the second week, you add one more mile. Gradually, weeks after weeks, finally, you reach the 26 mile. That is how it is in the mental health. If you're going to eventually run the marathon and talk about something so painful, you can't do that in the beginning. You have to build towards it. And that's what's important. And I wanted everyone to know that. So I added a sort of a bonus step at the end of the book where I talk about, okay, if you really insist on doing processing, you can do so on your own if you feel strong enough. I have done it many times myself. Of course, I'm a therapist, so I'm lucky in that way. But I know people who can, right? And so here's how you can do it. I like therapeutic writing as one of the best tools if you're doing it on your own. But I still prefer that it's done with a therapist, without a doubt.
I think it's helpful that you take that stance, because there are too many books already that can open up, so too many practices, anything you could say, that if unsupervised could lead people to go down a dark road. It's not that we think people are fragile, they're very resilient, but it's like, is this worth doing to yourself? And sometimes the answer is no. Like, not, it's not worth doing to yourself without the proper buffer, having someone there to serve as a guide to help pull you out when you start to dissociate, meaning feeling like you're not in the room, feeling like you're there in the trauma. You go into detail on dissociation in the book, which I think is very important, you know, zoning out, spacing out, feeling like you're not there, things like that. Those synonyms are very important for people to know. Obviously, being mildly distracted is the same as dissociation. You'll know the difference. It's a severity thing. But going pure reprocessing without a therapeutic element, without being pulled out and put back in, without titrating it, pendulating, whatever you want to say, can be more harmful than helpful. Yes. And it's very easy to write about, well, do this thing and overcome your fear and it'll be easy going from then on. It's not always that way. But the good news is we know what does help trauma now, so we can make that easier. We can make that understandable.
Right. When I work with clients and when I teach them grounding techniques or mindfulness techniques or body scan techniques, I don't only ask them to do it in my presence. I actually really like that they do it regularly as homework between my sessions. So that's also an important thing for me to mention. So that's why it's, you know, the processing is at the end. So I see you 1 hour a week and then I'm going to see you the next week. Well, in between my sessions, if you haven't done anything, then you may not build that muscle of, because being in your body, being present is also is like a muscle and it requires practice. So when I teach it, I go, okay, between now and next time I see you in my session, practice daily, at least twice a day, and then let me know how it was. And the next time they come in, that's where I start, first of all. How did you feel after the session? Did it make you feel worse in any shape or form? Did you do my exercises? And if not, why not? Then it gives me information about how committed they are, right? And how much they are ready to go to the next phase.
That is absolutely amazing. Yeah, I think we have to keep in mind that there's really a structure to this, and the paradox of it is very much like you're trying not to think of something. Like, I'm not gonna think about my trauma. It's like, well, that's not gonna work. And then you're thinking, I'm not going to do X, Y, Z, or I don't want to be upset. It's like, well, let's reverse that. What do you want? What steps can you follow that are active and positively phrased? Because whenever I have clients come in and say, well, I don't want to feel this anymore, I'm like, that's a great starting point. So what would you feel? What would be the next thing you want in life? It's like, oh, well, that's a very different question. That's like the miracle question, solution-focused therapy, where it's like, if you woke up and stuff was gone, what would you be doing? What can we do to work toward that now?
Right. Yeah, goals.
Very powerful stuff. I'm excited to hear about you developing your own modality, like incorporating so much physical stuff. Some of the quotes I really like from the book are things like, you can't connect the dots when you're disconnected. And you're very authentic. I think what you just talked about, therapeutic writing, you talked about your love of writing, and that gets into your statement, your whole thing about believing that negative thoughts are enemies, maybe writing it down, journaling them, leaving them, and saying, it doesn't even matter if I like myself right now. I just have to get these negative thoughts out and realize they're not helpful.
Negative thoughts is, I want to say, maybe one of the most common symptoms that I see when working with people. Right away from the beginning, I start asking, so you saw that as an example there, I say, how is your relationship with yourself is a common question I ask to clients in the beginning, because they're not used to looking at it that way. They're all looking at other relationships with mom, dad, brother, husband, wife. Okay, how are you doing with yourself? Oh, what does that even mean, right? So focusing on that really changes the person's attention to more of to themselves, and then see where we can, because the good thing is your relationship with you is up to you. Your relationship with other people is never going to be completely up to you. So there's a sense of empowerment is sort of how I look at it.
Yes. Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And another quote that I like is, can you order a ceasefire inside yourself? That was a good one. That's very visceral. Like, can you take a moment to get away from these thoughts?
Right. Well, you can feel it when someone is in self-hatred. They come in, they look almost, they came out of a battle. Well, I started seeing that in their posture. Their bodies sort of collapsed that way, like the head going down, and as if someone just beat them up. And you can feel it. So as they move into the self-forgiveness or really understanding and letting go of the judgment, their body posture changes, and they don't feel this heavy weight on their shoulder. And I said, wow, it was almost like you were beaten up. And they go, that's right. And then who beat you up? Oh, I was beating myself up. So the awareness of that really makes a profound change in a person.
Yeah, I think that's another thing is the importance of posture. And a while ago, you know, years ago, that idea of the power posing came out, and people took that to a very extreme level. And then people said, "Oh, that study's not replicable." It's like, well, okay. So depending on whatever you're studying, maybe, maybe not. But it is like you cite in the book, like having people sit with good posture while feeling sad is difficult. They report difficulty in that versus like reporting it feels rough to be happy if you're sitting with your head hunched. Like it's very easy to see there that there is some huge relevance of posture to move and vice versa.
Right.
And the careful teasing out of like someone's posture indicating that they have regressed and like helping them one step at a time relinquish that posture, put their feet on the ground instead of curling them together, put their shoulders back and walking through that, even that is great prep work that is starting somewhere and making a big change on something people would never think to. And I think one big point that's going to really come across as an epiphany to a lot of people is let me go directly from my note on your, okay. From one of your 10 points to remember lists,
right.
Number 7, spend less time with your thoughts. People really believe that they can think their way out of things sometimes.
Yes.
And the truth is a biased observer is never going to objectively view something, and you have to get out of that loop of thoughts.
Yeah. Well, I actually realized over the years that I was addicted to thinking. It's sort of a weird way of looking at it, but I really did, because I thought if I don't think something bad could happen, or I'm very analytical, I thought, well, I can find a solution if I think hard enough. And so if I didn't think, I thought, well, am I in denial because I'm not thinking, you know, like that being a psychologist, that's a disadvantage. Then you think everything is that you're in denial.
Yeah.
And then I realized, no, it's almost addictive. Like I just couldn't stay still without going into thoughts about something. So now I practice this in sort of weird ways. Like when I'm in an elevator or when I'm in a doctor's office and waiting, do you notice how frequently people are on their phone and just kind of looking? I on purpose don't take that. Don't take my phone, leave it there. Sit for that 5 minutes, 10 minutes I'm waiting, and I just practice grounding as I'm sitting there or as I'm waiting the elevator, rather than being uncomfortable. Oh, I'm just waiting. Like I just go, okay, let me just become really aware of the moment, really feel my body. The elevator is coming, what sounds I'm hearing. So I take little opportunities like that throughout the day. If I can't just sit down and do official grounding exercises, that's one way to do it.
I think that's really funny, because that's almost like a version of like sprinting or something when you're very upset. Like it's a, like a thing where you're fitting in exercise when you can, right? It like physical exercise almost, but except mentally you're telling yourself, you're looking at your triggers, like the trigger for awkwardness, like I'm feeling something in my body and I'm going to resist the urge to engage in avoidant behavior, to avoid the present moment by looking at my phone. Something that simple And when you're intentionally doing it, really catches up and recodes the way you look at these situations in the future. I think that's such a good example for listeners to hear. It's very succinct. It's something you start doing today. Notice when you want to avoid the present. What does it feel like?
Right.
To breathe deeply, to resist that, and tell yourself, I can take this 30-second elevator ride without using technology as a buffer. Can I do that? Can I do 20 seconds? Can I do 10? Like debating with yourself almost on new behaviors.
Yes, exactly. And the more you practice, the easier it becomes.
Absolutely. And that's, I think trauma survivors really can take heart in that, in that you're not going to understand right away. Like you have to believe that on credit almost, that it gets better. You're not going to view that you are broken and this happened to you because you weren't strong enough. Like, you're going to get through that, but there are first steps. Like, thinking isn't usually, like, a better relationship with your thoughts sometimes comes about through not dwelling on them, not through cognitively solving it. Like you said, the addiction to thinking, it comes through attention to your body and through stopping those thoughts, or lovingly telling them not now, and then go, and you know, that mindfulness of being mindful of not wanting to be mindful, being mindful of wanting to beat yourself up, and going through that, and then looking to the body. And very early on, you give examples in the book. Again, I think this is a good point that a lot of other books don't hit on. Like, you give examples that really stick. So you had a male client who didn't really get what it meant to, like, go in your body and be a detective on your own moods. And so you're like, well, how does that feel in your body right now when you talk about being sad? It feels like this. Okay, what happens next? Anger. Okay, what happens after? What does that feel like? Clenching, all this. It's very simple, but people don't do it. And so it doesn't matter how simple it is if someone's not doing it. Like, it's not helping them.
Yes, but with practice, anything can be perfect, or we can learn it. You know, we just, I said this too, in the Western world, we are very much focused outside about what to do, what we have to get done, and there's not enough slowing down time, unfortunately. Well, we can create it. We can create it in different ways. Just, our world is different. We're not in caves, or we're not in a Buddhist monk situation where all day they can meditate, right? That's not necessary. But within our lives, within the Western world, how can we create a bit more grounding, being in the present and reducing the amount of thoughts? Because trauma is in the past. And so when it hijacks you, you're stuck there. Or in the worry of the future. So the more you can stay in the present, the more actually you'll be able to manage the trauma symptoms.
Yeah. And I really appreciate how early you bring people's attention in the book to this idea of self-abandonment, of this introjection of a neglectful parent state. That's where I get a little psychoanalytic with this idea of internalizing the aggressor, like internalizing their view of you and continuing to neglect and abandon yourself far after their work is done.
Right, exactly.
It's a continued choice. And so lovingly drawing it, I say that because it's like you're not blaming the person for blaming themselves, because that gets into that loop that trauma patients often get in of, oh no, I feel upset now that I was upset at myself, and I feel upset about that. It's like, no, mindfulness of it, recognition, breath work, body work, somatic work. The more intellectualizing someone tends to be, the more they stay in their mind, the more they need that. It's like the opposite. It's like mental alchemy, where someone who overthinks isn't often going to get out of that. I like how you bring up that your tendency to overthink helped you to analyze yourself and set where you weren't going into your body. You wrote on that, and I thought that was really helpful for people out there who may not, they may think, yeah, well, I can't get out of this, or this is too fluffy for me. It's like, no, I'm a psychologist. I like to think, here's how I got through it.
Right. I don't teach anything that I have not practiced myself.
That's a mouthful. I think that's what makes the book come across so authentic. It's because it's not theoretical, it's not hypothetical, it's applicable. It's, this is something, and here's how it works, and here's who discovered it, and here's how you can try it. So,
good summary, thank you.
Oh, yeah, I appreciate, yeah, of course. Awareness is the first step of staying grounded and present. I liked that quote. That was really, and we just went over that a lot, so maybe I'll not pivot too hard into that. But, oh, sexual abuse survivors hating their bodies because of their bodies freezing up or other reactions that happen with abuse, that is such a dark but necessary point that I don't think that we really, I don't think it's talked about enough in some ways. I get that it's triggering, but I think we have to be authentic in it, because through EMDR work, I noticed people were really having these reactions to their body to even thinking about what happened and blaming themselves. And working through that is the aha moment, realizing that your body didn't do it, that your body froze up and didn't protect you because you were just trying to survive. You didn't know what to do. It was shocking.
Right, right.
So you call your body the messenger of the pain, not the perpetrator. I thought that was very poetic.
It's true, because the hatred is, that's the self-aggression, right? It's like, they hurt my body, now I'm here. Like, the body is not the one who did that. It's someone else's body. But often, because the perpetrator is never going to take the blame or the guilt, the victim takes it, which is right. Very, very unfortunate, but that's what the reality is.
Yeah, it sucks. One of the things I say usually is, you're never responsible for your trauma, but unfortunately, you're always responsible for your recovery. But the good news is, you can have therapists and other people alongside you to help through it. But I think grief and trauma, I love how you mingle the two, because grief's often trauma and trauma is often a form of grief, right? Like, you have, and I'm not taking away for either one of those concepts. What I'm saying is, there's the stages of grief. Like, there's the anger, wait, this happened and now I have to work to get through it. There's a righteous indignation that clients have from that. Like, when they stop avoiding and think, now I have to go through the work to heal something that I didn't even do.
That's right.
And so that becomes kind of its own thing, that's really where it's important. I mean, all these steps are important for therapists to be there. The prep work can be done on your own with this book, but I love that you talk about working with a therapist, because I think that element of really explosive traumatic anger, that I would almost, when clients started to get angry with EMDR, there's like this expedited processing where they'll notice they're sad, and maybe they'll notice, wait a minute, I didn't do this. I view it as a good thing when they start getting that way, because then they're starting to externalize what happened, and right, they're starting to identify that it was someone who did it, and it's actually a really good sign, because it means they're getting closer to really relinquishing that ownership, that hatred of their body and hatred of themselves. And then you work on, well, it's, you know, getting that out cathartically and whatever, and that not becoming like a huge obsession, but it at least, like, that anger becomes a signpost for, like, okay, you've removed it from their own identity. You've taken out how that defines them.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Such amazing stuff. I mean, is there anything else you want to share about the book? There's so much here to get into, and I don't want to, I want to make sure I hit anything you want to share.
Anything we didn't cover as a sort of an end thing. I think I like, actually, where I, at the end, I have a letter to the readers. Shall I read that part?
I would absolutely love that.
Okay. Dear reader, first of all, I want to thank you for reading the trauma map. It took me quite a long time to make the decision to write a book. However, once started, I experienced the joy of knowing that I could be a guide in someone else's growth or healing. And I decided to write it, even if it meant you're the only person I helped. There's no greater joy than being the support system, helping someone else experience their life fully and without trauma. Being able to really help someone feel better was at the root of my decision to become a therapist to begin with. The trauma map is another extension of that desire. I have always wanted to serve other people, to help them change their lives. It has been important to me to reach out with this book, especially to those who can't afford therapy. Mm-hmm. Over the years, I've seen so many people impacted by traumas, big and small. I have also witnessed thousands who have had neither the chance to eliminate their trauma by getting treatment, nor the opportunity to work through it. That is why my biggest passion is to educate others about what trauma means, how it impacts one's life, and how to give them hope so they know there's really a chance to come out of it. And then the last paragraph, I hope you get more than you expected out of this book, and if so, inspired that you share it with others. That's it. It was just about, and the importance of, like, really, there was another section about just please be present, stay in the moment, and then you can heal much more that way.
Wow. I really love that. I think that's a great place to wind down. I mean, that compassion and the psychoeducation it's the next best thing to having you right there, a therapist right there with the client.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me, Dr. Darsa.
Thank you for inviting me, Jeremy. It was a pleasure.